so serious.
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game? Yeah!
Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, it's the 420 edition of the Toy Department. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. How are you, sir? Are you working today?
Nope.
All right.
I feel like I should cough for effect, but no.
I feel like that answers a lot of questions.
I am not yet enjoying the splendors of legal marijuana on April 20th, its most hallowed day.
But a complicated
day nonetheless.
For someone like myself who's not currently a Bay Area resident, California voted for full recreational. Is that in effect yet?
So the way it works is there's nowhere to buy it legally if you're not a medical card holder.
You can just have it.
But you can have it, and medical card holders are allowed to gift up to an ounce of marijuana to whoever they want.
So for you to legally...
To a legal adult. I think it's 18 or 21, probably 21.
All right, so if I live there and I don't have a card, then essentially what you're saying is I need to find someone who does and have them purchase it for me?
No. They have to gift it to you.
Sorry, not yes. Ask them to purchase and then gift to me?
Yeah, no, I mean, if you gave them money for some other thing, right, that would be none of my business. But
right,
in terms of the marijuana, they would have to gift it to you.
Okay.
Up to an ounce.
And so is there any plan for people to, like, you know, to go Colorado style where just anybody could roll into a dispensary? Or?
Yep, that's about a year away.
It's a year away. Gotcha. Okay. All right. That's a good update. Thank you for that. I feel like we should drop a programming note here for those of you who didn't see it on social media yesterday. We're going to be doing this podcast on Thursdays. We're going to be recording on Thursdays for a while. Typically, we record the show on Wednesday, and you get it usually the same day. But we decided to do Thursday so we could talk about a couple shows that air on Wednesday without it being like a week later and super awkward.
Yeah. Because you want to listen to the show before you watch more than we have.
That's correct. You know, the other way, you were probably ahead of us, most likely.
Yeah, so, or like sitting down to watch the new one, listening to us talk about something that like it was going to be irrelevant in 10 minutes.
Right.
So it's better this way.
So
I've thought about this before. I think during other seasons, it might be like football season, it might be good to go like Tuesday. I don't know. We'll discuss this, but... Also, while we're noting things, I've made a note to myself in my head and my, loose sieve of a mind to make more notes about, like, hey, you know, we're people in the world on Twitter, at the Kolsky and at Madden on Air,
and that you should follow us and interact with us in some way.
And subscribe to stuff and whatnot. You know, iTunes.
That's right.
Google Play. We're on all of it.
Leave us a rating. I don't even.
Really, out here.
I'm going to be 100% honest. I don't even really know what leave us a rating does, but everybody asks you to do it, so do that. Rate it.
Seems reasonable, man.
I have not checked our ratings at any point. Do we have reviews on there or whatever?
I have no idea if we have ratings. I haven't checked the email.
Yeah. Okay, so what we're asking is put slightly more effort into listening to this podcast than we do in creating it, apparently.
This is a call to action for myself.
For all of us. Mm-hmm. Go out there and do stuff, people. It's, you know, I mean, we're already assigning homework, so I feel like we ask a lot as it is, but whatever, do more. All right, so let's...
Well, but the homework is, you know, that's tongue-in-cheek. It should be fun. You should enjoy the homework. Don't do the homework if you're not enjoying it.
But does that go for me, too? Because sometimes I don't enjoy it.
Well, no, of course that doesn't go for you. Okay. But more importantly, like, the homework we really give is things like the show we just set the show up for.
Yeah. We also want you to have a good time. That's what we're thinking about when we assign the homework in fairness.
Have a good time.
That's right. All right. So let's jump into last week's homework. And one of the reasons we're doing this show on Thursday, the season premiere, season three premiere of Fargo last night. Oh, man.
First of all, I just love hearing the accents again.
Yeah, I do too. I got to tell you.
I was surprised how much delight I got out of purely the accents.
Well, you should come visit sometime. You can get all of that all day long.
Yeah. How much of it is to you like, oh boy, it's people I talk to every day?
Not that much. I think one of the things that's interesting to me about season three is that, you know, it's creeping closer and closer to me and where I live. The first season was set in Minnesota, correct? And then, but like kind of, way up north and, at a different time. And then they went to the 70s, but now we're in the 2000s. And, Ewan McGregor's character apparently lives in Eden Prairie, which is most definitely a suburb of Minneapolis that is not very far from here at all. Not Eden Valley, Eden Prairie. And I'm not definitely not fully versed in the towns of Minnesota. I'm not sure there is an Eden Valley. I could be wrong about that. I know there's an Apple Valley. I know there's a Golden Valley, but I don't know that there is an Eden Valley. I do know Eden Prairie. So, but regardless, yeah, it feels a little bit more real. And you definitely do hear some of those accents, but it's maybe not quite as pronounced as it might be if you went to an area of rural Minnesota where you're getting all the oh no's and you betches and all of that stuff.
Okay. All right.
People here just say things like big and tag, you know.
Uh-huh. Stuff like that. Vag sort of? It's weird. It's one of the weirdest,
Yeah, it's very subtle. It does speak, though, the accents and all of it just speaks to how richly drawn the world of this show is. And there's a establishing kind of scene in the first season where they're in a sort of a different time and a different frame. And it's one of those, at least for now, you have no idea how it ties into the story, although I'm sure we'll figure that out at some point. And then at the end of that, there's this like picture on the wall of this guy's office in Berlin in 1988. And they run through that picture to sort of start telling this story. And you kind of, there's this great shot where they sort of go into the picture and then the picture kind of becomes what you're watching. And the second you like sort of open up into that like rural Minnesota, although I'm guessing it's probably Canada, shot, you're instantly transported into the world. And the music and the accents and the general nailing of the Coen brothers vibe, like this show gets all the little things done so right every time. It really is such a pleasure, and it just sucks you in from the jump.
Yeah, it's well said. I mean, it he is awesome, Noah Hawley. I especially after just watching Legion, which was such a sort of tricky, like, view obfuscated, if that makes sense. A sort of weird, like, I'm picturing, you know, those little code decipherer things that are just like a piece of cardboard with holes in it that you put over letters. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Legion was like watching one of those slide around something where you're just seeing like bits and pieces that have to fit in weird different ways that ultimately hopefully make a whole at the end. Whereas Fargo is like this very direct storytelling. And I just think in macro approach, what they're doing overall, they're so wildly different, but that you can almost tell it's by the same or similar artist because it's the execution is so flawless.
Yeah, watching Legion, I feel like really gave me a much better understanding of the Hawley like visual style You can see a lot of the visual things that they have in common. And it really is remarkable to me because, you know, Holly's background is as a writer and like a novelist. But the visuals in the show, whether it's the photography or the set design, you know, he's got a great flair, obviously, for the actors and for, you know, the musical cues in both shows are tremendous. And it's amazing how many different things he gets right and how many different little aspects of television he's good at, you know?
I'm also a big Ewan McGregor fan, and I love a good, you know, character turn from Scoot McNairy, who was a delight in the first episode. You know, it's one of these things where we set our expectations very high for this show coming back, and I am always wary of overrating or overrated things, and this was just absolutely on point, met every expectation you could have had. I'm thrilled it's back. I'm excited to keep watching it. And I'm already wildly invested in the like madcap antics that are about to go down because we got a really good establishing of the crazy situation that we find ourselves in Minnesota.
Yeah. And I think we're probably somewhat at the tip of that iceberg.
Oh, yeah. Of course. But it's like it's a meaty chunk.
Yeah. I mean, and look, Ewan McGregor, I think, is going to get a lot of notice. Obviously, it's a showy opportunity for him because he's playing two characters.
Yeah, slight spoilers.
Yeah. And they share scenes with each other at times, which I did not really see coming.
Yeah, and I found myself wondering if, like, one of them will die soon.
Yeah.
But either way, they're very different, and I think he plays them very convincingly. And so it is a showy opportunity, but he's also, I mean, Ewan McGregor has done some things that I think have allowed people to forget, but he's really a tremendous actor when he gets after it, and this seems like an awesome set of roles.
Good part for him to sink his teeth into, and I'm very excited about Carrie Coon, who plays the one character that seems to be the common thread in all these stories is the cop who is really good at their job and yet somewhat underestimated by the people in the police force. At the same
usually
time,
a woman, because that probably happens to women all the time.
Although I mean, you know, the Patrick Wilson character in season two kind of
that's true.
You know, sort of similar, and you know, but devoted family person on top of that, and you know, that I think it's going to be a great role for her. She's a tremendous actress. I don't know if you're a fan or not.
Sorry, who? Which one?
Carrie Coon,
and she plays the. Mustached down on his luck, Ewan McGregor's girlfriend?
No, she's like the chief of police there.
Oh, she's the chief. Oh, yeah. Okay. Both of them. I don't know either of them, I don't think.
Oh, really? Well, there's another show that Carrie Coon is on that maybe we'll talk about later in the show.
Oh, boy. I really walked right into that one.
Yeah, you sure did. Sure did. Set it up, nodded it down. So anyway, Fargo is a delight. If you want to bring out the belt metaphor, I think it's almost unquestionably the best show on TV right now, but I think it's in the conversation for just the best TV show that's currently being produced.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when we get into that, I think Game of Thrones always has a leg up.
Yeah, well, look, Game of Thrones is certainly another show that's definitely in that conversation.
But I'll say this. For quality, for story, for beauty of the visuals, as you mentioned earlier, for acting, for every category in which you would rate the quality of a television show, Fargo stands on its own too with any show that's ever been on television.
It's
the best thing you can say about a TV show, and I wouldn't hesitate for a second.
Yep, it's in the elite. So if you're yeah, not
I
watching
mean,
and
everyone knows the shows. You know what I mean? It's The Wire. It's Sopranos. It's
Breaking Bad.
Yeah. It's in that pantheon. And the fact I think it actually gets its own special bump because it's an I think it's got to be the best anthology series ever, right? Is there anything else you would put in there?
No, I mean, not, you know, I mean, look, I think given the first season of The People versus OJ, you'd want to see what season two looks like. And that could potentially be in the conversation.
But don't you think
short list, right? It's like, I mean, you know, there's True Detective. Well, I think Fargo's better than True Detective as much as
people
I like
Detective. American Horror Story.
American Horror Story. And then like The Twilight Zone. like that's pretty
Black much. Mirror.
I guess Black Mirror. I guess I wasn't really thinking of that as a television show. Yeah,
so that's different, but.
So was Twilight Zone. And there was, remember Amazing Stories in the 80s? Were you around for that one?
I know of it, but I was not.
Definitely
not
part of the template that, you know, Stranger Things arrives from.
Yeah.
And Tales from the Crypt. I forgot about that one.
Yeah, of course.
So yeah,
how dare we?
I'm going with Fargo.
Tales from the Hood? No, just me? Okay.
First Intent? What? No. So to me, Fargo's up there, and I think it's in the conversation, you know, with Game of Thrones and Ballers for the show that's, you know, just the not the GOAT, but the current.
Wait a second. Wait a second.
Sorry, just seeing if you're paying attention.
What? You think I'm just like so over here spaced out, not listening to what you're saying?
I was really hoping, like, did he say Ballers?
Wait. What? And listen, I love The Rock as much as the next guy. I literally have a mandate with an old college buddy to see The Fate of the Furious today.
Oh, nice.
Seems like a good 420 movie, right?
Sure. You know, I made the decision to say Ballers and then just keep on talking and just to see how long it would be before you stopped me.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, it's good. I guess, you know, you put me to the test. If there's a day to put me to the test, today's the day, and I'm glad that I was able to pass.
Nicely done. Should we talk about the other show that we're saving this podcast for Thursdays for now?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's much to add to what we've said, but it really is so wonderful. It's to me, it's got all the like absurdity of an Eastbound and Down, but also sort of the like the heart of something like. It doesn't reach for the artistic heights like this, but of like Louie or maybe a better, you know, Better Things. Is that the right name?
Yeah, that's the right
Pamela
name.
Pamela Adlon.
Yeah, like people are learning in this show. I think sometimes, you know, but it's also filthy and
right. It is filthy and it's over the top and it's ridiculous, but it also is like. It does have this weird heart of like, he's still kind of a real person.
And there's a genuine appreciation, I think, for the game, too, that beats Beneath.
Yes,
that helps
if you're a baseball fan, you'll get that much more out of it.
So, I know that Brockmire's already been renewed for season two. So this is not like a plea of like, please watch this show so it stays with me, you know.
IFC is the sort of station that will run a show for five years, no matter what.
People should watch this show, and it's one of my missions is to get more people to watch the show because I just want to be able to talk about the jokes with people. Really, as much as anything else. So
that's like I don't know if we've ever we've talked about Brain Candy at some point on this podcast.
Brain Candy, the Kids in the Hall movie.
Yeah,
I think maybe it came up at some point. I don't know. We talk about a lot of things, man.
Well, we're going to assign that. I'm going to assign that as homework sometime when we don't have so much going on. But it's probably my favorite comedy movie of all time.
Really?
And, well, I mean, it's in the conversation, yeah. Like in terms of silly, goofy comedy stuff, you know? It's up there with Dumb and Dumber and Bad Santa You know,
I'm not sure I watched that movie since it came out. And I feel like I do think reviewing it, might be a, I might get something out of it.
Really well. I think the sort of awkward comedy they did in that film has aged really well. It fits in a lot better to the current comedy scene. I just think it's so incredible. And there's so many lines in it that I want to quote on a daily basis. And it's the most fruitless and frustrating opportunity or desire, because no one knows what you're talking about. And it's usually like weird stuff that doesn't seem to make any sense.
Yeah. And look, you know, to sort of take it back to Brockmire, like, we could talk about the show like we would talk about Fargo and talk about the chemistry of the leads and, you know, how the show has heart and some of the things it does from a writing standpoint. And those are all true. But, like, I don't want to obscure the fact that it's just really effing funny.
It's so funny. It's so funny.
It just makes me laugh. And
Hank Azaria,
watch it for that reason, you know?
Yeah, Hank Azaria has always been a sort of comic genius in his own right. He does so many voices. He is a weird thinking, like, comic actor who has done a lot of things that probably would surprise some people in the voice department. One of the most used voices on The Simpsons.
I would almost say unquestionably the most used voice on The Simpsons. He's like dozens of characters.
Yeah. And this is just like a chance for him to really stretch out in an acting role, and it's beautiful, man.
Yeah, and you know, you can tell this is a character, you know, and Hank Azaria created the character of Brockmire. You can tell this is a character that started with a voice and then it's just kind of been fleshed out from there. But fleshed out in a really interesting way.
Yes, yeah, and really with care, I think. It's great.
All right, can we shift gears to the show that I want to badger you into watching?
Yeah, I suppose so.
My phone's blowing up there, sorry. Yeah, I want to talk about The Leftovers, man. Here's the deal. Like, I was bugging you about The Americans. Before this season started, and I think that's a worthy goal. The Americans is certainly one of the elite dramas on television. How is that going for you? Your Americans catch up, by the way.
Well, yeah, that's going to be the chief argument against your plan to get me into The Leftovers.
Well, I'm going to turn that on its head, because I think this is sort of an argument for The Leftovers, because The Leftovers is every bit as an elite a drama as The Americans is, but it's a much, much fewer episode commitment in terms of catching up. You know, we're one episode into the third season. Neither of the first two seasons is very long. I think this is probably the 19th episode. You know what I mean? A total of the show.
So, I'll check.
So it's definitely not as steep of a climb to get back involved.
Now, where are you on the whether or not to watch season one?
Oh, I really enjoy season one. Now, season one is certainly the heaviest.
Wait a second, Liv Tyler's in this show?
Yes, she is.
Huh.
Yeah, quite a bit at points. It's very, season one is definitely the heaviest in tone. And it, because it's heavy, it's not a show.
10 episodes each season.
Yeah. Sorry. So we're 21 episodes in.
Uh-huh.
It's not a show that's easily bingeable in that regard, in that, you know, especially season one, it takes a little bit of a toll. But man, it really is rewarding and bonkers in a way that, like, were you a lost person?
Yes.
Like, all of Lindelof's storytelling.
Yeah, I do like him.
Gifts are really put to good use here. And it's a show that has some mysteries, but like whether or not we answer the mysteries is not sort of the it's not the central question in this show. It's a little bit more just about, you know, what happens to people when they try to deal with something, you know, with loss on this sort of insane level and scale, and what it does to us as people, and then, you know, where we go from here, and you know, yeah, so it asks some really big questions, which I sort of like, but beyond that, the acting is so good, and the storytelling is so bonkers, and there's so many like, wait, what? Whoa, kind of moments in this show, particularly once you get to season three, it's wild, it's funny, the acting is tremendous, it looks great.
It's funny though.
Yeah, it can be funny. You know what I mean? Like they especially by season two, once they got the tone right, you know, I think this is a show that really knows what it is and knows that it can be kind of heavy and sad at times. And so I think that they have taken some moments to lighten it in certain ways. And it just, it's one of the best looking shows on television as well. You know, they get a lot of film directors. I was reading about Mimi Leader, I believe is the way you pronounce her name, who directed Deep Impact and a bunch of other things, and then kind of got sucked back into TV, and how she's really taken a big role in sort of creating some of the style of this show. Yeah, it's just really good television. And I think, honestly, it's like me and some TV critics who are watching it, because the ratings for the show are poor. But
wait, does it even really have ratings? Is it on HBO?
HBO has ratings, absolutely. But you know, also like, you know, this is also not a situation where, like, you know, this is the last season. So
it is?
Yes. So you know, it's kind of has a compact end. There, I believe 8 episodes in the season, and then we're done.
Yeah, that's correct. 8. You know, you've made a compelling argument.
So yeah, dude, get into The Leftovers, because I think you will.
Here's what I think's probably going to happen. Because of your compelling argument, I'll watch one episode, maybe two, and then I'll be like, well, to be honest, I could easily see myself being like, all right, and then just plowing through it. But I could also see myself being like, no, I'm depressed. No thanks.
Yeah, that could happen. I mean, look, I still haven't finished Big Little Lies, so I understand. That's not depressing, and it's not bad. I just, you know.
Oh man, I didn't find it so depressing. I think it's.
That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying it's depressing. I'm still haven't finished it. It's just, you know, I'm a little peak TV, and
yeah.
On top of that, it's the NBA playoffs, and there's like compelling basketball on every night.
Yeah, that's a real problem for me.
You know,
I'm with you on that.
So that's, get that from a time perspective, which is why I'm saying, like, try to carve out some time for Leftovers. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's not as big a hill to climb.
I'll see what I can do.
All right, and that goes for all of you if you're not watching The Leftovers, because it's another show I'd like to be able to talk with more people about. And mostly now I just read like Sepinwall and Tim Goodman recaps to get my Leftovers discussion fix in.
I'll tell you what, the cap of 28 episodes though is a real appeal.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, here we are, I've seen 21 of the 28, and I have only the vaguest idea of where it's gonna go. So
that's cool.
So I like that. And they're just really some great characters. It shares sort of that thing in Lost where you know, by season two, they really kind of focused the episode from like maybe one or two characters' perspectives in the way that Lost would sometimes do. And you really sort of deepens your understanding of these people in each of those episodes, you know? So that by this point, you really, you know, a lot about people. Some people who do some seemingly strange things, you kind of understand maybe a little bit more why that happens, even if they always don't. So
I'm in.
Yeah. Yeah, give it a run. I like that. But I feel like my work here is done for today.
You made a really compelling argument. I got to give you credit.
Sepinwall called season two one of the great seasons of television ever.
I've heard that from I've heard multiple sources reporting season two of The Leftovers really excellent. But in fact, some of the sources have told me to start with season two.
Yeah,
that's why I asked.
Yeah,
you.
That's sort of the Andy Greenwald thing. He's kind of on that tip of like, hey, just start with season two. He didn't like season one that much.
I have a feeling I'm going to be aligned with him, but I'm sort of a completist, as we all know.
Yeah, so I can see how that might be tough for you. And I would say if you're really worried about time and whether or not you can fit it all in, then yeah, go ahead and start season two.
I'm just not sure where my fragile psyche can handle that.
Should we talk hoops?
Yeah, let's talk a little hoop.
Since we brought it up, real quick, because now it's everybody's seen it and it's old news. But I think we both really wanted to take a minute to salute Coach David Fizdale of the Memphis Grizzlies.
Take that for data. Damn it! I meant to start the podcast today by saying that to you. Take that for data. I have no idea what it means. It doesn't mean anything. And as many people have pointed out, the best line by far of the whole press, the whole rant was, they ain't going to rook us.
Yeah.
Or they not going to rook us. Whatever he said was tremendous.
We're not going to let them rook us. Yeah. The whole rant was tremendous.
That's real. That's real stuff. You know? Like, he got fined $30,000 for it, but he was responding to real stuff.
Yeah, and he knew it was going to happen. And he was like, let me, I'm going to go in here. I'm going to talk about the officials. I am certainly going to get a fine. And I'm going to come here and I'm going to take that fine. I'm going to get my money's worth.
And I'm going to get some damn calls next game.
Yeah. So
Because it really, he's right. He's right and it's wrong.
Yeah.
Look. As a fan of the Bulls in the 1990s and thereby a fan of Michael Jordan, far be it from me to complain about the superstar call. But the superstar call is one thing, and there's two other things that happen in the NBA now. One is the just over-the-top flailing, which is very frustrating to watch and I'm not a fan of, and I wish they would stop allowing to draw foul calls at least. But also the second thing is like, there's this idea of respect for certain teams, mostly the Spurs, that there's no reason the Spurs should get a million bajillion calls against the Memphis Grizzlies. Like, that's a veteran quality Grizzlies team with Mike Conley, with probably the best guard in the NBA never to make an all-star team, with Marc Gasol, a perennial all-star level center, with Zach Randolph, one of the toughest veterans in the entire league. They shouldn't get rooked by referees against Spurs.
No team employing Vince Carter should be rooked ever.
Exactly. He's 53 years old.
Jerry Stackhouse just won the D-League Coach of the Year, and Vince Carter's still out there playing.
Isn't it incredible, some of the guys that are coaching, though?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if you know, Jerry Stackhouse's reputation is as one of the, like, realist and most dangerous in a street fight.
Yeah, like flat-out toughest dudes in the league.
Ever. And now and Rasheed Wallace is an assistant coach somewhere.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's wild, some of the guys that get into coaching. It's funny because just because that's Jerry Stackhouse's reputation and just because Sheed is what we know Sheed to be, it doesn't mean they don't have great basketball brains, you know? And to see guys like this turn into mentors and advisors and coaches is just pretty awesome.
Yeah. To bring it back to Fizdale for a second. First of all, I mean, look, I knew the name, and he was with the Heat last season, right? I remember when they hired Fizdale. Like,
you know Fizdale from, if you watch enough NBA, you recognize him as that dude from down the bench with the glasses.
Yeah. Like, I have a borderline awareness of David Fizdale. Mm-hmm. But he went from guy I have a borderline awareness to guy I would like to play with for in 90 seconds.
Hero. Hero coach.
like that is like, and to me, that's worth $30,000 right there. You know what I mean? Like,
no question.
That is a dude who is out there standing up for his players. And what I loved about this, like, when you look at this rant, alongside, the great press conference rants, we let them off the hook, or playoffs, or practice, you know, any of those. Like, almost all of those are meltdowns. You know, I'm a man, I'm 40. You know, like
meltdowns. Our favorite ones, Lee Elia.
Yeah.
All like, that stuff. Those guys lost control. David Fizdale knows did
exactly,
not lose control.
He knows exactly what he's doing the whole time. And
yeah,
that's what I love about it. And then, maybe as a result of it, there's a mic drop. It's the George Costanza. Yeah. I hit the high note. I'm going to get off the stage. And yeah, it's so perfect. I love it.
Oh, yeah? Well, I went to the jerk store, and they're all out of you.
Yeah. Boom. I'm out. Congratulations, Coach Fizdale. I'm sure it's going to be the greatest thing you do in these playoffs because you're probably not beating the Spurs. But
no, they're not. But you know what? I think he's a good coach. I think the Grizzlies have the potential to create a good situation moving forward. Like, things are not bad for grit and grind. They're not. This team probably doesn't get over the hump, but like, I like what they have.
I gotta say, I'm feeling like my Celtics prediction from last week looks pretty good at the moment.
Yeah, you know, my father has now started antagonizing me about how you're going to antagonize me about the Celtics.
I'm not.
I have a short statement.
But I'm just curious where you're at in this series because you have an emotional investment in the Chicago Bulls, right? So,
well, I like to think my emotional investment is in the overall franchise well-being of the Chicago Bulls.
Okay.
Which makes this team the most frustrating, pointless feeling nonsense I think I have ever witnessed as a Bulls fan. I was texting a friend about this yesterday and said, and I think I sincerely believe this, that I would rather watch the Tyson Chandler and Eddie Curry team than this team. Just from a long-term perspective.
Not an aesthetically pleasing basketball team by any measure.
No. And aesthetically, this team, the way it played the last two games, aesthetically, this is much better to watch than that. Or like the crappy Ron Mercer team. But it's so pointless. Like, for what is this? What is this for? Is Rajon Rondo a part of the future of the Bulls franchise? I can't imagine that he is.
No, there's still.
Nor is Dwayne Wade.
There's still a misfit franchise, but it's like you're here and you're in the playoffs. Well, you might as well keep punching, right?
Jimmy Butler, who is proving to be one of the top, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 players in the NBA, who is proving he can carry a franchise in a playoff environment, who proving it again. Like, now in the offseason, we're going to be talking about trading him again. And maybe, you know, it's just I'm tired of a team with no plan and nothing on this roster that I feel like I can count on for the future or even that I can know will be on the roster in the future. Nothing, not one player.
But I mean, look, maybe they'll talk about trading Jimmy Butler. But I mean, like a Butler, Mirotic, Portis, like, those are
that team's not winning anything.
Those are you got pieces there.
It's at least one other star away.
Sure. But you know you're definitely gonna free up some cap when Dwayne Wade and Rondo aren't there anymore, right? So,
I guess so. I have to suffer through what two more years of this.
Look, it's a process. And right now, look, I mean, you're in what a lot of people think is the worst place for an NBA team to be, which is in the middle.
Yeah, the 8th spot in the friggin' Eastern Conference.
It takes a minute to get out of that. You know, I grew up rooting for the Atlanta Hawks. I know. So, you know, either you bottom out or you find some pieces and you move up. That's kind of what happens.
Well, right. But that's the point.
But in the meantime, you have a legitimate chance at the conference finals all of a sudden. It's like, why sneeze at that?
I don't think so.
I don't know, man. I think this team playing the way it is,
Washington could be Washington. Good. Boston has real problems,
but they could.
And those problems are expounded tenfold by the awful, tragic situation surrounding Isaiah Thomas. Like, they just, it's a really tough thing to analyze, But I think you have to think of this almost as like Isaiah Thomas tweaked a knee. You know, like it's not a physical ailment. It's not an athletic detriment, but there's no way he can be 100%.
Like, you know,
his little sister died days ago.
I get what you're saying, and I don't necessarily disagree, but I personally, I'm not comfortable speculating on what is in Isaiah Thomas's head or his heart. And the guy dropped 37 points the day after, so it couldn't have been that, you know, debilitating.
Except it just changes. It has an effect. And all I'm saying is he's the one guy they couldn't afford to be affected negatively in any way,
but
from a basketball perspective.
Look, I think all the stuff that, you know, sorry, there's not really any way to say this without sounding like I'm tooting my own horn, but I think all the stuff I talked about last week about how I don't feel like the Celtics, that the playoff basketball suits the Celtics.
Well, right. Well, that's the other thing.
That stuff is all true, and I think Thomas is part of that, you know?
He absolutely is. And I'll make a brief statement about the Brad Stevens discussion, which is simply that there are many factors that make the Celtics a better regular season team than playoff team. B, their position as the one seed is somewhat fraudulent based on injuries and uninspired play from at least two teams with better rosters, certainly better rosters suited for the playoffs in the Raptors and Cavs.
I wouldn't say it's fraudulent, and, but we know. I think we all know they're not the most talented team in the East. I think fraudulent
because they didn't earn their wins.
Yeah.
Fraudulent because 53 wins was the first seed in the East this year, and because I think their Pythagorean expectancy was like 47. You know, so they won some. They won. They're more than their fair share of the sort of close, could go either way type of games. And also a low win total got them the first seed. So like it's the fact that they're the first seed should not be overrated. That's sort of a meaningless number. And that, so there's that, and that stuff is all about the Celtics. The other thing that they have unfortunately come up against is a team that, if it played this way all year, would have been the fifth seed.
Yeah, I mean, look, they're facing a team that's hot at the right time.
It's not even hot at the right time. It's at least two and arguably three guys who are the best three guys on the team who just clearly don't give a toot about the regular season. And you can argue that in the case of Wade especially, and maybe Rondo a little bit, it's a matter of self-preservation, and that if Dwayne Wade tried to play this way in the regular season, he wouldn't have anything left come playoff time, and that's fine. But nevertheless, this team played up and down, often like dogs, throughout the course of a mediocre regular season, started to get it together enough to push themselves into the playoffs, but not enough to get above the eighth seed, and now is playing like the, you know, probable fifth seed that they are. And if you think of this as like a 4-5 or 3-6 matchup, it's much less shocking. So all of that takes some of the weight of having the worst postseason winning percentage in the history of the NBA off of Brad Stevens.
I didn't know that stat. That's a good one.
But I also
be sure to trot that one out later.
I have to admit that he has been at least matched, if not outcoached, by Fred Hoiberg through two games of this series.
Who has the best postseason winning percentage of all time?
Well, fine, but that is
minimum two games.
That is not convincing. That is not a great positive mark on one's resume.
It isn't. And look, there's you know how in romance, right? Where it's like if you're that sort of person that's like, oh God, I always seem to find just the jerks, or oh, you know, at some point you have to go, no, guess what? It's you. Like you're the common denominator in all these things. And when you go back through the Celtics playoff series, like in each of them, you can find a thing that you can point to, this injury or, you know, sadly a death in this case or this circumstance or whatever. But at some point you have to go, well, maybe it's them. Like they are the common denominator. And
I do think though, the biggest takeaway more than about Stevens, the biggest takeaway here really is it, and always should be the narrow takeaway is the roster is flawed. And the broad takeaway is it's always the roster because is it that Fred Hoyer? And again, it hasn't been, Brad Stevens clearly has not had a coaching advantage, but is it really about coaching or is it about the fact that Dwayne Wade, Rajon Rondo and Jimmy Butler, three players who are all capable of playing very well when motivated and physically capable, are all playing near or at their best while Boston's best players are not.
Right. Well, I mean, and they're usually not coming into these series with the best player on the floor.
Clearly the number one player on the floor in Jimmy Butler by a long shot.
So,
especially if Isaiah is not playing his best, Jimmy Butler is far and away the best player in this series, and he has made that obvious.
And look, my contention is not that Brad Stevens can't coach or that he's some choking dog or whatever. That
no, like, I know.
Can't coach in the playoffs. I think the Brad Stevens hype train has left the station at a very high velocity, and I just enjoy slowing it down. That's all. I find it very enjoyable.
All right. Well, I'm glad you're enjoying yourself.
Yeah, it's high quality trolling. all right. So one more basketball. Let's get one more playoff thing going because you know it's worth it. The playoffs have been really enjoyable to me.
Excellent.
So, far.
So many good games so far.
I read something from Tim Bontemps, who is the lead NBA writer for the Washington Post.
What's funny is I think it's just Bontemps.
Is it Yeah, right. I think it is Bontemps. It should be Bontemps, though, right?
It should be like Bontemps, but or something.
But he just goes Bontemps. Yeah, you're right.
But he does not go Frenchy, so it's just Bontemps, I think.
I think I'm going to refer to him as Bontemps, if that's okay with you.
It's fine with me.
Yeah, so he wrote a piece in the Washington Post about Russell Westbrook and how he's kind of the like how you feel about him is the current NBA Rorschach test for how you feel about basketball. If you don't know, the Rorschach test is like the ink blot things where you look at some random blocks and describe what you see in them, and it's supposed to reveal something about you.
It's about you, not the blot, is the point.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so what you see,
whether or not you like Russell Westbrook or what you think about Russell Westbrook really says more about you than it does about him, and I think that is probably very true.
Yeah. So, here I'll read the quote. You know, to put the numbers up, Russell Westbrook did Wednesday night, which was, 51 points on 43 shots, and a usage rate of 54.7%.
Yeah.
To put the numbers up, he did Wednesday night as well as this season. Westbrook turned the Thunder into the closest thing into a basketball team can be to a one-man show. And by extension, that means this. Either Westbrook is doing what he has to carry the sorry cast of characters that surrounds him, or he's been far too controlling of the game and his team and unwilling to trust them to do what's necessary to help him win games.
In the fourth quarter alone, Russell Westbrook was 4-for-18 from the field, which is under 25%. I won't do the math past that because who cares? And 1-for-7 from three-point range, where he is consistently a poor shooter.
So which side of that equation do you fall on? Is he doing too much or just doing what he has to do because otherwise they're screwed?
He's clearly doing too much. See, okay, here's my position on Russell Westbrook. The first thing to say is he's incredible. He's incredible to watch. He works hard to be great, and that is not to be dismissed or underrated. No one's working harder than Russell Westbrook. I believe that he sincerely believes that the best chance for his team is to do exactly what he's doing, which was to shoot the ball a ridiculous 24 times a game all year and an absurd 43 times yesterday. I think he's wrong. And therein lies the problem. because this was his best 3-point shooting year by far, and he shot 34% from 3-point range.
He's not a great 3-point shooter, and he never has been.
Exactly. And that he thinks it's better to shoot 7 times from 3 than to move the ball. And a lot of his
11
shots
times
in the fourth quarter, because I watched.
11.
I mean in the fourth quarter alone, he shot 7 times from 3-point range. And I watched the fourth quarter, and a lot of his shots were taken without any real offense, without moving the ball around usefully, without anything. And where Russell believes, and his most ardent supporters would believe, that it's because everyone stinks around him and the only chance they have is for him to go totally nuts and carry them, I believe the exact opposite is true. It doesn't even matter what I think of the supporting cast, which I think is probably a little underrated.
I think it's actually quite a bit better than people give it credit for.
It might be, but it's
because they need that narrative to work. You know what I mean?
Hold on a second. We can agree it's not a great supporting cast, whether we say it's better than people think or not. It's not great. It's not an elite supporting cast. They don't have the stuff to be a championship contender in all likelihood. However, they're not a championship contender, but they're also now
building the team around these things that he does, which they weren't doing in the Durant era, you know?
This is my exact point. Is I would argue, where Russell and supporters would argue that the only way to win is for him to do everything, I would argue that you will never win with one player doing everything. Never, ever in the NBA. You'll never win a title with one player trying to do everything.
Wasn't there one Kobe do everything season where they won?
Not really.
I thought there was, like, towards the end of that run, there was one of those.
Nah, he always had Shaq or Powell and Odom. And if you believe that there's no way to win with one player doing everything, then even if your supporting cast isn't what you'd like it to be, you go about using your skill to try to make them better, which is exactly what James Harden did all year, which is exactly why I would have voted for James Harden for MVP. And I'll give you a perfect comparison. A year ago today, if I gave anyone the choice between Eric Gordon and Victor Oladipo, everyone's taking Oladipo. Eric Gordon was a washed, always injured, never panned out type of player. And now everyone's fired up about Eric Gordon because James Harden has helped him succeed and has consistently put him in positions to thrive with open 3-point shots. Victor Oladipo has to get his offense on the plays where Westbrook decides not to shoot and just kind of hands it to him on the perimeter and says, okay, your turn.
Yeah.
Because they don't run offense, because everything is just let Russell decide. And Russell Westbrook has no interest in participating in an offense that allows everyone to touch the ball. And when everyone is touching the ball and feeling more involved, usually everyone's offense improves. And you see it with teams like the Warriors and the Rockets, where the stars enjoy, and Kevin Durant is a part of this, which gives you great insight into why Kevin Durant didn't want to stay in Oklahoma City.
Everyone killed him for it when he sort of made those comments in the offseason, which, by the way, I don't think we're quite as directed at Russ as the Tony Kornheisers of the world made it out to be.
Everyone assumed it was a direct shot. I think the guy was just being honest.
Yeah.
You can't play a team concept with Russell Westbrook doing what he does. And so they're never going to win with him unless he changes. Because he's proven already you can have another superstar there. You can have one who's arguably the second best player in the game, and he's still going to play his way.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, look, I'm not a fan of you're never going to win that way, because if you somehow wind up with a Kevin Durant on your team, those teams, they didn't win, but you can't say they never were going to win. They made a finals and were, a ridiculous comeback away from being in the finals last year, a series that I think they probably would have won had they made it. So,
but as close as they were,
Now,
that
look,
style drove away.
Sure. And the likelihood that they're going to walk into another Kevin Durant is low. So,
it's nil.
Yeah, it's low. I like you. I feel like I need a caveat. Like,
he's
so
incredible.
So much respect for Russ.
Yeah, he's incredible. He's a Hall of Famer.
Yeah,
he's undeniably incredible.
I like Russell Westbrook the person much more than I like Russell Westbrook the basketball player. I don't really enjoy watching him play, which is
really
almost impossible given the feats of athleticism that he is pulling off. Like, don't
I
get
find
me wrong.
That surprising.
Like, I like the the highlight plays and the dunks, and I appreciate the manic intensity.
Right.
But
I love to watch him.
But I don't like watching a guy never pass and just, try to bulldoze his way to the hoop every time and brick three pointers. Like, that's not, No,
to me, I enjoy watching him. I would never want to play with him.
I don't really like any of these super high usage guys in terms of watching them play, and that includes Harden.
I think is less enjoyable for the most part to watch than Westbrook.
Those like crazy Kobe seasons. Better. That's just not my jam. I like passing.
I agree.
You know what I mean?
I agree.
So that's where I fall on the Rorschach test part of that, and that is by no means. I mean, it is a knock, but like. Westbrook's great. I'm not trying to say he's not great. I just don't think that's the way to play basketball.
What the Westbrook people have to understand is that there's not a single NBA follower in the world who is serious and paid attention that would not have put him in the top four of MVP voting this year. Not a one. There's not one. Every single serious NBA person would have put him in the top four of the entire league. But yeah, he has a flaw. And it may be, in NBA terms, somewhat of a fatal flaw.
It's a weird flaw. It's like, he tries too hard, he wants to do too much, but like, it's still a flaw.
Yep.
And so, there are a lot of people out there who are just ardent, Westbrook worshipers.
Even Kobe found a way to share. And if Russ can't find a way more fundamentally to share, I don't think he'll ever win a title.
Did Kobe find a way to share, or did he find a way to coexist?
I would say he found a way to share with Powell and Odom.
Hmm.
I mean, I think he was forced into sharing more in the first three because Shaq was still the dominant personality on the team. The second two titles with Odom and Gasol, I think he legitimately opened up to those guys, especially Lamar. I think it took a special individual and basketball player in Lamar Odom to facilitate, but it took a special individual and basketball player in Scottie Pippen to make Michael Jordan work.
Yeah, it did. I don't know. Jordan sort of is like a weird part of this debate, because people look at him as a one-man show, and then some people say, like, really he's the best example because he figured out he couldn't quite do everything, and once he learned to, I do think Jordan was a guy that made his teammates better
in a way
that Russell just doesn't,
Agreed, and in a way that Kobe really didn't either, for the most part.
But
Kobe got to that stage more with that Lamar and Gasol team.
Yeah. So I guess that's where we fall on the Russell Rorschach test. And I'm not here to say that the other side is wrong. It's just the way that I look at basketball. I do believe that it's team first, And
like, again, honestly, if you want to argue he's the best in the league, like, I think you're wrong, but you're not a total lunatic.
Yeah.
Like, what am I going to say? He shot it 43 times. I don't think that's the right way to play. But it's not like any old jerk could shoot 43 times and get to 51 with a triple-double. Like, yeah. It's not peanuts. It's not nothing. It's not an unimpressive thing.
If anyone could do it, Dion Waiters would have done it by now. You know what I mean?
That's exactly right.
So, all right.
That's exactly the point. Russell Westbrook, as much as these conversations end up being largely critical, he's not Dion Waiters. He's friggin' Russell Westbrook. He's tremendous.
Yeah, he's great. Would you say that Kendrick Lamar throws up 43 shots on his new album?
He's like 34 for 43. I get the guy. I don't know how I'm interested to hear how you've experienced this, because it's been a grower for me. The first time I listened to it, I was like, good album. Good album. A little bit of a come down from To Pimp a Butterfly, but what wouldn't be?
Right.
The more I listen to it, the more I'm like, no, this thing's pretty damn good. It's getting into me. I mean, I still think Humble is the best track. But it's awesome. And DNA is a killer. Like, there's a lot of good singles on this album. More so, I think, maybe even than To Pimp a Butterfly.
It's not a great singles record, I didn't think, To Pimp a Butterfly.
No, it's a great record, but there's, you know, King Kunta is the only single that stands out, I think. Yeah. This thing's a banger, and it's not thoughtful. To Pimp a Butterfly was this opus with free jazz on it and spoken word, and, like, you know, that sets it apart in its own way. But this thing is a great hip-hop album.
Yeah, look,
I really think it is.
There's certainly a lot to like. Like, he's obviously just incredibly gifted lyricist and flow, and there's a reason he's at the top of the game, and the G-Funk samples are
excellent.
Just the fact that he's, you know, one of those guys kind of still doing samples and doing it really well, I think is excellent. The scope and the ambition and the, hey, here's Rihanna on this song, and oh, here's Bono. We're gonna bring you two for this song. And like,
and this is, people have talked about this plenty, but Rihanna just rapping for the most part.
Right. You know. People like to parse the lyrical shots in it and all that's great. On a personal level, for me, and I say this more really as a person than as a critic, it's far too spiritual for me. I just, like that part of it is a turnoff. So,
I think I'm just used to sort of.
I keep it I a little know, bit.
Ignoring isn't the right word, but I'm used to
passing over it.
As a hip hop fan.
Yeah, I had the trouble with the Chance record too. Like, it's just too damn churchy for me.
Well, but Kanye too. Like, it's hard to take that stuff too seriously as the sort of religion that concerns.
With Kanye, you don't, because he worships himself. But like,
I think Chance is a very sincere.
Kendrick and Chance are really serious about this stuff. You know what I mean?
I don't know about Kendrick. I don't feel like I know as much about his.
I've heard he's quite devout.
But I feel like. I feel like I understand Chance's faith, and I feel like it's pretty positive.
Yeah. And by the way, like, I'm not trying to knock their faith or their expression of their faith. Like I said, I'm not being critical. I'm just, that's a taste issue for me. Like, I don't personally enjoy listening to that.
Right. I get that. Jesus Walks always troubled me.
Yeah.
Kendrick is not that. It's not that overt, I don't feel like. And for whatever reason, Chance's, like, the way he expresses his faith doesn't bother me at all. It might just be I'm so infatuated with him as an artist and performer. But with Kendrick, it's not a thing I think about a ton, although it's clearly part of the imagery and metaphor of this album. Like, it's not, and he directly talks about it, but it's not like I feel like I'm drowning in religious commentary.
Yeah, I just want more shots at Geraldo. That's what I want. You know?
He's such a clever lyricist. He's such a good rapper.
Yeah.
I mean, really the best we have right now. And it's wild. He can do so many different things with his voice, with his flow. He's, you know, people... I don't want to litigate the whole Eminem battle, but to me, that's the, in addition to taking the sort of Jay-Z major rapper belt, I think he also is holding the Eminem wild lyricist and flow artist belt, which I think is a rare double.
Yeah, rank. I mean, he, you know, when you say he has the belt, it's kind of like undisputed, right? Like, if when you say who's the best in the game, like people go Kendrick and they say it real quick. You know what I mean?
So yeah, I don't even know. I mean, I guess who's second? Is it Chance?
Yeah, that's probably not Egos? For me to answer. Probably, but I would say Chance probably is what most
is
he, people
is
would
it
say.
Like is it Migos or Gucci or Young Thug? Someone from Atlanta?
Yeah, I don't know, man.
Like it gets a little muddy after that, but I think Kendrick, I think he's got to be in the top spot. I mean, Jay-Z's out of the game, it seems.
Yeah,
for the most part. So I don't even think, like I said, I don't even think there's a clear two. I think Kendrick is way out ahead of the game. I mean, Kanye occupies a weird space.
Yeah. yes, that's true.
But it's hard to rank
in this discussion and in the world.
Yeah, it's hard to put him anywhere. But Kendrick, I mean, yeah, he's got it all. He's got all the rap belts, all of them.
Yep.
He's gonna sell the most. He's the most talented. He has the best flow. He's getting the best beats. He's. I mean, the humble beat is just like. Like I just thinking about it makes me want to jump up and down.
It's rare that it all lines up like that.
It really is. I can't. Who else has held the rap game title like that? Tupac and Biggie sort of battled each other so toe to toe. I'm not sure either of them ever had it.
I feel like there was a point where there was like where Jay was sort of undisputed.
Jay-Z for like a few year stretch. Yeah.
Like once, 10, he kinda, 10 once, years ago, right? Once he kind of shed the Jay-Z Nas like battle, uh-huh. Yeah,
like the Black Album, Black Album, Jay-Z had this spot where his flow was killing everybody, and he also was the biggest name.
And he was working. He was the guy finding all the great producers, and you know,
yeah, all that. Getting all the best beats, everything.
Yeah,
and I can't, I'm not sure the rap game in its entire history has had any other undisputed kings besides Jay-Z at that time and Kendrick Lamar right now. Like, yeah, I don't know maybe. Who it would be.
Would you say early like on, there Public was Enemy maybe had a point?
But that was pretty murky. They didn't. I'm not sure they had the pop game locked down the way they didn't these have the guys sales. Do.
Yeah. I mean, maybe straight at NWA, Circus Straight out of Compton, but not.
Yeah,
you know, maybe.
But I don't think I don't. Well, maybe their flow at that time was still pretty.
You had some guys with some mediocre flow though on those records. You know,
that's what I'm saying.
Right? Yeah, it's fair. Like I mean, like I love Eazy-E, but like you know, he's not like a yeah.
He's he more has, of a novelty some limitations. Than a. Yeah. So even Dre is like, you know, it's
right. Dre's another. Yeah. Dre's another. Say no more.
MC Ren is probably like the best rapper in there. I guess I shouldn't disrespect Ice Cube. Anyway, the point of this is, you know, Ice Cube actually probably has a decent argument in the early 90s, but there's so much competition then. I'm not sure
that was a really tough era.
All right. So Kendrick is in this unique, awesome space, and it's cool that in that space, for the most part, I think he's making really interesting music.
Yeah. Yeah. Appreciate it. Well, what's going on? Let's do homework so we can get out of here. You got anything? Because I do.
Yeah, well, we already did it, but we should talk about the new Joe Swanberg film, Win It All.
Oh, yeah, we were going to talk about that on this show because we watched that.
We just ran out of time.
We didn't tell you guys we were going to watch it, so now we're doing that.
Yeah, watch the Joe Swanberg film, Win It All, on Netflix. It's excellent, I would say. I'll give that away. And also, I'm going to it sparked an idea of an avenue by which I am going to pursue a Joe Swanberg interview for this podcast, which I would say has at least a 10% chance of happening.
I thought you were dreaming of becoming a professional card player. That was going to be the spark.
I have no disillusions. I am not a good gambler.
I'm going to throw another Netflix thing out there. Because if I recall, you like me enjoy an occasional teen drama. No?
Mm-hmm.
So
I love it.
So I'm going to assign the new Netflix show 13 Reasons Why.
Really? I don't want to watch a show about suicide.
Well, I mean, yeah, I'm not going to say it's not about suicide, but it's not.
Why are you trying to make me watch all the depressing things?
It's not. I don't think it's a particularly depressing show.
Oh, it's a happy suicide show.
I wouldn't say it's a happy suicide show either. It's all right, so you know, and I'm also not saying it's a great show. I'm more curious as to what you guys think about this show because I'm like four episodes in. I like a
teen drama with heavy comedic elements. Are there heavy comedic elements?
They're mild comedic elements, I would say.
Yeah, I don't know, man.
It's really got some. I don't know. There's like it in a lot of ways. To me, it reminds me of like a Rob Thomas kind of Veronica Marsy kind of mystery.
That has heavy comedic elements.
Yes, that does have some heavy comedic elements, but it's a lot in the way of like these people are trying to piece together what happened with this girl, and it involves talking to a lot of other people who, you know, are trying to hide some information, and you're sort of going through and learning as it goes. And I think it does. Look, I'm not even going to get into what I think. I would like you to watch a couple of them and see if it's for you or not. Look, The Leftovers is much heavier than this show. I promise you that. It's not like, right. It's not a trip to depressing town necessarily.
So, Unpleasantville.
And I would also say, you know, I mean, a lot of the story is told in flashbacks. So like, yes, there is a girl that committed suicide, but you're also seeing a lot of her as a living person. You know what I mean? So.
Oh, good. Oh, good. The preamble to suicide. How delightful.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. For those of you who haven't heard too much about the show, this girl does kill herself and she leaves tapes for all the people who she says are the reasons why. And each episode focuses on a tape or something that's a side of a tape in a given case.
It's like the most morbid fantasy I've ever had come to life.
So, yeah, to me, it's more of this show has a really interesting concept and the premise kind of got me going. And I wound up watching a few in a row and I just kind of want to see where people are at with it.
All right, nerd, I'll do it.
Thank you very much. And I think we should leave it at that because that means I've already done all the homework for next week.
Wait, what?
And I like that because I've seen Win It All. And... Now I've seen this show. So yay me.
Damn it. How'd you come out on top like this again? All right. Bye.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.